This episode of the Moments of Joy podcast has been brought to you by The Support Circle. I am so excited to share with you that I've opened the doors to our 24/7 online support group for parents raising children with disabilities. Why should you join? We have monthly group sessions. We uncover resources together. We will have live in-person events, 24/7 group chats. You'll be able to connect with parents that are located near you. You'll be able to receive early release of episodes, live stream recordings of guests, and we will hear from professionals like teachers, parent experts, nurses, chefs, the list goes on. And most of all, you get to build authentic relationships with other parents from around the world that are like you. So if you're in need of support and a support circle of parents like you, come on and join The Support Circle by Moments of Joy podcast. Welcome to the Moments of Joy podcast. My name is Camille Joy, and I'm the host of this show. This podcast is dedicated to a very special group of parents, parents raising children with disabilities. There are an estimated 240 million children across the globe living with disabilities. And here on this podcast, it is my goal to create community for the parents raising them. Community locking arms from all over the globe. I pray that as you listen to each episode that has been handcrafted for you, you leave encouraged, you leave strengthened, you leave educated, and you even leave with some resources. So come on into the room, take off your shoes, relax, come on and take a seat on the couch, and let's experience moments of joy. Welcome back to another episode of the Moments of Joy podcast. Now, MVPs, I am so excited to have with us today Caitlin from the documentary Love on the Spectrum. I had the pleasure of watching the whole series, United States and the UK, and then following her and finding her on TikTok and Instagram. So I just tried my luck and reached out, and we have her here today. Welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Thank you.
You are so welcome. I think most recently, one of your reels on Instagram really helped me as a parent and some of my community when you spoke about going out to eat and why you thought about wearing headphones, and you gave us so much insight. So I love your platform.
Thank you. It's really comforting to hear that, like, it really helps people, because, I mean, I get those comments all day, and I really do appreciate them, but it's different when you hear it from, like, a real person saying, you know, oh, this was helpful. It just, I don't know, it feels more real. So thank you for telling me that.
You're welcome. Yeah, because especially raising nonverbal children, my little guy's 5 and his name is Mason. We have no idea what's happening. And right. For you to actually tell us was eye-opening. So we'll get right into the show. We have so many things to talk about, and I know you are busy, so we won't keep you long. But can you start us off with a little bit about your childhood and how old were you when you received your first diagnosis and maybe your second and what that was?
Yeah, I was born in Vermont. We lived in New York shortly after I was born until I was 7, and then we moved to South Carolina. I was diagnosed when I was 10 years old. My uncle lived in Orlando, so we drove to Orlando and I spent 5 days there. They did 5 days worth of testing at a facility that had a wide variety of professionals. That's where I got diagnosed, I think, with dyslexia and dyscalculia and ADHD and autism, just kind of everything, you know, because when you spend 5 days there, I guess I would hope that they would come up with a lot. They were very thorough. I think at the time I would have described it as boring, but, you know, looking back, it was very thorough.
Wow. Well, I have to ask, do places like that still exist?
I don't know. I would assume that place is still in business. Last I checked, they were. I know that incredibly expensive. I think my mom said it was around $10,000 out of pocket, which was something that my uncle was able to pay for at the time. But that is a privilege that most people do not have that privilege.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because as you're talking, I'm like, wow, 5 days. There are parents who are on waiting lists for months. And someone told me their waiting list is 24 months just to find out what's going on.
Which is so crazy. That was, it's such a delay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing that you were able to receive that and get so much knowledge for your parents right away. So what therapies did you take as a 10-year-old?
I think at the time I had seen an OT kind of on and off. I remember a couple instances of speech therapy. I remember that not going super well. I was not the most cooperative child. And so if I didn't think I had to do it, if they couldn't convince me that it was important, I just kind of wouldn't do it. And so they didn't really want to continue paying for therapy that I wasn't going to be super cooperative for. When I was in high school, I had to see an OT for 6 months to be able to drive. And so that's kind of where my motivation kicked in, is if you don't do this and if you're not going to participate, you don't get to drive a car. And that really kind of definitely motivated me to continue with treatment.
I'm going to give us a disclaimer here for the listeners, because out of all days, they want to mow the lawn outside today. So excuse me if you hear. But wow. So 10 years old, you received OT. Your mom is getting this diagnosis. Do you know, or have you heard of how her response was? How did she take it when you got those diagnoses?
She was really, really upset. It was 15 years ago, so I don't remember a whole lot. I do remember, I think I was playing upstairs with my sister and we came downstairs for dinner and she was cooking chicken nuggets and she had burnt them and she was crying. And my mom is not one to cry a whole lot. She's just a very strong woman. And so she just does not, cry a whole lot. And so it was very unusual that she was crying. And so I asked what was wrong and she said, oh, nothing. She kind of blamed it on the dinner, and which I knew, I knew it wasn't that. And I could kind of hear her talking to my dad, and I knew it had something to do with me, but I didn't know what, and they didn't really tell me the full story until several years later.
Wow. Do you know, at 10 years old, what was it that made your mom say, I think I need to have her seen?
I think it was like a combination of, she'd been really trying to get me evaluated for quite some time. She had seen several doctors saying, Kaylin is experiencing noise sensitivity and there's, lots of insistence on sameness and routine and the lining up of the toys, hand flapping. So a lot of the symptoms of autism, she was actually able to recognize really early. It's just that medical providers weren't really interested in, giving her some sort of like evaluation or a referral for an evaluation. They would say, oh, she's a female and she's speaking. It can't possibly be autism.
Wow, because if you don't mind sharing, what year was that? Because, it's 2022 now. Doctors have heard this more often. So what year was that where doctors weren't really, that open to sending you?
Early 2000s.
Yeah, wow. Well, I'm glad that we've evolved to a place where, at least some doctors are more open. I remember telling Mason's pediatrician that the daycare providers noticed a little a difference in him, and my pediatrician told me he was fine twice and don't worry about it. But, I'm glad I followed my gut, to help him.
That's good.
And so I heard you mention your sister. So you're not an only child.
No, I have a younger sister and a younger brother.
Wow. That's beautiful. Okay. So what are some of the things that are important to have in place for children going through school? As someone who's on the spectrum, what do you think is important for them?
I think it's really unfortunate that most schools won't really advocate for children unless they have a really supportive, system at home, which, like I said, not everybody has. So schools are not quick to be like, oh, hey, this person, is having some challenges in this area, or we could better support them by doing this. I think there's a lot of schools out there that do that, but I would say the majority do not. So I think it's really important that kids have supportive family members or caretakers in their life to be able to advocate for them.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think as parents, it is difficult. As you talked about your mom crying away from you guys and you seeing her, I could totally relate to shedding some of those tears. But as you spoke about the support, our children need our support. And so, you know, you let go of whatever you had, whatever thought of perfection you had in your mind, and you begin to embrace your own child's perfection, because they're still perfect, right? They're still your precious, perfect little babies. But embrace and be of support. So I love that. And when we do that, it helps our family members and our friends. I didn't write this question down, but you also spoke about your uncle. So your mom had a support system. Your parents had a support system raising you.
A little bit. I only saw my uncle a couple of times, and he passed away recently. We weren't very close, but he was able to kind of help them out, I think, financially with that evaluation. So it was really huge for me, I think.
Yeah. Wow. That's beautiful. And thank you for that clarification. All right. So we'll get into the topic of Love on the Spectrum. I think we all enjoyed that show, and we all enjoyed your transparency. I know that that had to be hard, you know, to put yourself out there, and especially at the topic of love. So why was it important for you to be on the show?
It was important for me to be able to tell my story, knowing that it looks a little bit different than the stories about autism that we see a lot, especially like in the media and how it portrays them as, you know, these super genius white men, really. And I definitely differ from that stereotype, especially having learning disabilities. And so I think it was just really important for me to be able to tell my story. And if I got a boyfriend out of it, I was definitely willing to participate.
Yes. You know, we all, something about watching TV, and especially a series when there's more than one episode, we all, you know, pick our favorites, and we want to fast forward, and we want to rewind, and you were definitely a favorite in the show. I wonder, you know, there was a part of the show where you said sometimes when guys find out that you have autism, they don't call you back. And so I remember you going on that speed dating adventure, and the guy seemed to be into you. We all felt like he was, and you know, he wanted to go on the second date, and he never called you back. And what a loss for him.
He was really bad at communication, ironically, because he was neurotypical. So his conversations via text were just very simplistic, and I really couldn't get him past small talk. And then we did actually set up a time to meet a couple times, and he canceled on me for like I think he was drunk. I think he was hungover is what it was.
Cause
he was
going to the college
game, and he was like, "Oh yeah, I can't make it," but he's the one who like made the plan. So I kind of fell through.
Wow. And so what encouragement do you have for other young autistic adults, or maybe, you know, teenagers who might experience that, where maybe on the outside, a person may not know that you have autism, but then, you know, they're discouraged from continuing on after?
That's a hard one, because for me, my response to that when it was something that I was going through was not to tell people until we got kind of closer. So if, you know, we would hung out a couple of times and we've been texting for a while, you know, I might share it then, but I wasn't super upfront with it. Now I don't really have that much of an option. It's kind of out there. You know, all you got to do is Google my name and you can kind of see it. And so I have some different feelings about it now, but I think for people who are, you know, not to that point and it's not out there, you know, you can't Google their name and find it out. I think it's an individual thing. I think in some cases it can be good to, you know, lead with that and just be upfront with it. But at other times, you know, sometimes it's private and sometimes they don't want to share unless they're close with that person.
Yeah, I love that. You know, you don't have to have it out in open. You absolutely can have it private. I have a lot of parents sometimes tell me, you know, no one knows that my child has autism, you know, and that's perfectly okay. Versus my side, I tell the whole world.
Right.
But I did so because I needed community. We had moved from Connecticut to Texas, and I had no more family or friends. We moved here for work. My husband's, you know, an entrepreneur, and we moved here without a sister or without a mom or a brother. And so I took to online and found community. And so, yeah, that was great for me. So we hear a lot that, and I'm sure you get this, you don't look autistic. So can you speak to that for us, that term, that phrase?
Absolutely. I think a lot of times that comes from what we see in the media, and when the media presents, this is autism and it looks this way, or they've got, you know, option B and this is autism and it looks this way, but you're over here at option C and they've never seen you before. I think the confusion makes sense. It's not my favorite thing to have to deal with, but I understand why people might be confused at that if that's been their experience.
Yes. And before you were on the show, were you open with telling maybe a friend that you met or work that you had autism?
No, not at all. Tell people that I was very close with, or if I had like a really good reason that I should tell them, but most of the time I would not share it unless I had to.
Okay. And what do you feel for us who have children who will grow to young adulthood? Do you feel like we should encourage that, or we should let them pick on their own? Or
the way I started out, kind of as a teenager and when I was a little bit younger, was I would tell people for a couple different reasons. One of them would be like if it was a medical provider in any capacity, you know, dentist, doctor, that sort of thing. The other reason would be if it was like a safety concern, so like a police officer. And then the third reason would be if I had, you know, done something that maybe I shouldn't have done, or something that, you know, got a interesting in a negative way social reaction, I would tell people, not necessarily as an excuse, but just an explanation. Hey, this is probably why that happened. I think that's a good starting point. And if, you know, the person decides they want to be more open with it, that's great. But I think that's a good place to start.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And what about family? What about us as parents? This is tricky because I just said I tell the whole world. But what do you think about that? Well, how should we lead with telling our family members and our friends?
It's really up to everybody as individuals. I think each family is going to have a different approach, although I think it is probably better to be more open, especially with family, because, you know, you're going to spend a lot of time with them. And it's just, I don't know, it's a really important part of the person who has the diagnosis. So I think it is important to share with family.
Yes, thank you. And I know I did so because for Mason, meltdowns were really big. I feel like I would want to have a meltdown once I got him calmed down. Because it was so, it took a lot for mommy to make sure he was okay. And I was concerned, right? And I didn't know if he hurt or not. He was hurt or not. And so I had to make sure that my mom, my dad, or anyone who would really watch him, you know what this is. He's not having a tantrum. He's having a meltdown.
Right.
Do you have meltdowns, or did you?
From time to time. I think now, like, it would have to be really bad. Like, I have a really bad phobia of needles, or like last time my car got rear-ended, that kind of set me off. So like it has to be pretty big to happen now.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So stimming. I feel like this is one of my favorite topics because I finally have researched a lot. So when I see my little guy's fingers going, or he's tapping his forehead, or he likes to do this now, it gives me flashbacks of when I would see other children doing this in school, or I was a part of the Best Buddies program when I was in high school. I don't know if you've ever heard of Best Buddies. But yeah, and it's a nonprofit that works with children and young adults, with intellectual disabilities or any kind of disability. And I was a part in high school where I would be their best buddy. And
that's
so,
cool.
Yeah, I feel like it's like full circle. Like God knew I would have a heart for them and now have this little guy, and definitely have a heart for him and all children who have a disability. And so I love seeing him stim. It's like the cutest thing. I know, you know, as he grows as an adult, I don't know how it'll continue to show up for him. I don't know what his future would be yet. So let's talk about stimming. Do you stim? Should we stop stimming?
Yeah, really everybody stims. I'm sure you've probably heard that before, you know, the clicking of the pen or twirling your hair, yes. tapping your foot, everybody stims. A lot of times I think parents wonder why are they stimming and thinking it's this big complex thing, but the short answer is it feels good. And people on the autism spectrum just tend to do it more and do it a little bit more intensely. And we can often use it as like a coping mechanism to kind of keep ourselves regulated or try and regulate when we are dysregulated. What was the other part of your question? Sorry, I forgot.
Oh, no problem. It was, should we stop the stimming?
Oh, right. I think generally no, unless there's a couple things. So if it's harmful to the person or to the people around them, or if it's disruptive to the environment, because sometimes stimming can be harmless, but maybe it's disruptive. And so it might limit the person's opportunities to engage in different activities. So if somebody really likes to scream or squeal or screech, but they also really, really want to attend a church service, that might be a problem for them. And so can, you know, not having a different stim might prevent them from doing something that they want in their lives.
Yes, yes. Speaking of church, this is one of the places where I love to go to church. It helps with my encouragement as a person and a mom, just in general. And so sometimes it's not always the best place for Mason. He doesn't like the singing. It's loud. Sometimes there's a lot of different lights. There's a lot of people. So I have to sit in the back and head towards the door. But I got into a class where they were teaching churches how to have an inclusive environment for children with disabilities. And so I look forward to helping my church to be that for Mason and other kids. Because a lot more children are growing up with disabilities. Well, not a lot, but we're finding out a lot earlier.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. We spoke about meltdowns. I talked about Mason's meltdowns. One meltdown that was the reason why my platform grew, I shared that Mason was going through about 3 or 4 days of just crying and tapping his ears. So I thought he had an ear infection, and I brought him to the ER to get, you know, evaluation to see what was going on. And he just turned into the Incredible Hulk, and he was fighting us and screaming. And the doctor looked at me and she said, "That's it. That's enough. We're not going to traumatize him." And so I left not knowing what was wrong. And we went to his pediatrician the next day, and she said, "He doesn't have an ear infection. It was probably something sensory." And I was like, wow, I didn't know. So now, you know, I know to turn the sounds off, turn the music off, turn the TV off, look and see if it's the fan. Is it some other sound that may be small to me, but it's really big to him? So meltdowns. Can you help us to understand what's going on when our children have meltdowns?
Yeah. So to me, I think a meltdown is just when the demands of life, sometimes just, you know, the daily demands of everyday life exceed the person's current abilities. So in order to kind of help somebody through a meltdown, usually, you know, we offer help. Do you need help with something? Give choices. And sometimes someone could be so emotional or so overwhelmed that they might not be able to make a choice in that moment. So, you know, giving them some time and some space, just kind of waiting it out to help them, you know, be able to make a choice when they're ready can be really, really beneficial.
Thank you so much. That was really helpful. For Mason, I found out what he likes by going down a list of things, because I didn't have anyone to really ask. So the weighted blanket, the weighted vest, I even went to YouTube and found autism calming music that helped him. Sometimes even just putting him in a car and taking him for a drive helped regulate him, or singing, or you know, firm pressure. But it is very hard to figure it out. Please share anything that you have going on, any books or any services, or is there anything that you would like to share with our audience?
I am everything is in the works for me right now. So one thing that I'm really wanting to work on is public speaking. And so I've been applying to a variety of different autism and applied behavior analysis conferences around the United States to hopefully get some speaking opportunities to kind of share my story and what's been helpful for me with just other people, specifically professionals and teachers. Just, I think a lot of this information, it's hard to come by. I think I come at it from the unique perspective of a lived experience as well as someone who has clinical experience working with other people on the spectrum. So it's not just my experience that I'm pulling from. And I think that can be really beneficial. So I guess just be on the lookout for that.
Yes. And please, and follow her on social media and email her if you have an organization or you'd like her to take part in your TED Talks and TEDx. And we want to see you go far. There's a couple of questions that I have that I did not put down. If you're open to a few more questions.
Sure.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes in showing up on social media for me, there's like a huge gap between the autistic adult and the parent. And so we want to be allies to the community and not ableists. I hear that word a lot. And so I'm like, I didn't really know, okay, let me see how me in this place and, you know, this position, how I'm being an ableist. And so how can we unite with the community of autistic individuals as parents? You know, so many things that are changing today, like the puzzle piece we no longer use. We're using the infinity symbol and, you know, different things. I know that it's important to stay educated, but what do you think is some other things?
That's a tough one. I generally don't really like extremist opinions on either argument, on either side of any argument. I don't think anything has ever been accomplished, at least not that had positive effects, with any kind of extremist views. Being moderate and being reasonable is the best way to navigate it. And also, I mean, I hate to say it, but part of autism is having a hard time understanding the perspective of others. And so when we get a bunch of us in a room together, it can be really hard to understand each other's perspectives because it's not something we're inherently very good at.
Wow, that helps a lot. That helps a lot, especially with just listening and understanding, because maybe the individual is having a hard time seeing your point of view.
Right.
Yeah, that's really good. I don't think I asked you in the beginning, what is autism?
It depends. I guess it does. A lot of people have a lot of different ways of thinking of it. By definition, it is a neurodevelopmental disability. I think some people take issue with the word disability, but I really don't believe that they should, because most of the people taking issue with the word disability are not people who have disabilities themselves. And it's not necessarily a good or bad thing. I think we can see it as a neutral thing. It's just there are some things that some people can't do, you know? That's just the way that it is.
Yeah. I love that you brought that up, because the other day I was saying to my husband, do you think I should say parents raising children with disabilities? He said, I don't like the word disabilities, which I hear a lot of parents say, my child is not disabled, but autism is a disability.
And disability, so what if they were disabled? What, so yes. What, you know?
So what? Disability is not a dirty word. It's not disgusting. They're people just like we are. And so I love that, because more parents can embrace that, okay, my child has a disability, and let's start changing what that looks like. Because the reality is, for many of us, we weren't taught. No one taught us how to receive, how to be a friend, how to, you know, accept anyone with a disability. We just maybe saw them in school not being treated the best or in public, and that's the view we have.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's up to us. And so, Kaylin, I don't have any other questions, but I want you to please share your social media with everyone. I'm going to put it in the comments, in the links on YouTube, and down in the iTunes, in the Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, and Google, and everywhere it's at. It'll be in the description of the show.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. We wish you well in all your endeavors. And is there any last bit of advice or encouragement that you have for parents raising children with disabilities?
Seeking out acceptance and community will, I think, well, this is kind of a tangent, so I'll try not to be too long. But I saw a video recently talking about how, like, kind of the worst disability you could have is loneliness. And loneliness is something that really plagues the disabled community, especially when it comes to autism or intellectual disability. So finding community and acceptance can really, really make the difference sometimes.
And that's great. And we'll leave it right there. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. We wish you the best. And we look forward to commenting and seeing your content online and watching you soar in your career.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Bye.